We are Daniel 8. We're going to be first 14 verses tonight. Okay. All right. In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, after the one that appeared to me the first time. I saw the vision, and it so happened while I was looking that I was in Shushan, the citadel, which is in the province of Elam. And I saw in the vision that I was by the river Ulai. Then I lifted my eyes and saw, and there, standing beside the river, was a ram which had two horns. And the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other. And the higher one came up last. I saw the ram pushing westward, northward, and southward, so that no animal could withstand him, nor was there any that could deliver from his hand. But he did according to his will, and became great. And as I was considering, suddenly a male goat came from the west, across the surface of the whole earth, without touching the ground. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. Then he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing beside the river, and ran at him with furious power. And I saw him confronting the ram. He was moved with rage against him, attacked the ram, and broke his two horns. There was no power in the ram to withstand him, but he cast him down to the ground and trampled him. There was no one that could deliver the ram from his hand. Therefore, the male goat grew very great. But when he became strong, the large horn was broken. And in place of it, four notable ones came up toward the four winds of heaven. And out of one of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. And it grew up to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host and some of the stars to the ground and trampled them. He even exalted himself as high as the prince of the host. And by him the daily sacrifices were taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. Because of transgression, an army was given over to the horn to oppose the daily sacrifices, and he cast truth down to the ground. He did all this and prospered. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that certain one who was speaking, "How long will the vision be concerning the daily sacrifices and the transgression of desolation, the giving of both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot?" And he said to me, "2,300 days, and then the sanctuary shall be cleansed." Okay, well, as you can imagine, there's a lot here, and some of it we really can't answer definitively. I mean, we're going to find options, but especially when we get to the 2,300 days. But for now, let's start with this. What Daniel sees, first of all, is a vision of a ram and a goat. And it's really interesting the way these things are described. And eventually, by the way, in the second portion, we're going to meet the Antichrist. So that, I think, is interesting. But here's what Daniel says. You know, I read these things and I still think to myself, what must that have been like? You know, he's not sleeping. This is an awake time. It's a vision. It wasn't a dream. It was a vision. So here he is, and he makes it clear that this is the one that happened after the first one, and he was looking. He was in Shushan, the citadel. And then I lifted my eyes, and there, beside the river, he sees a ram. The ram has two horns, but the one was higher than the other. And then eventually, he sees a goat. It's fascinating stuff.
Fascinating stuff. Anyway, let's get into this. So where are we in Daniel? Just a bit of a recap here. Daniel 1, chapter 1, takes place in the third year of Jehoiakim, around 607 BC. Daniel 2 is the second year of Nebuchadnezzar, around 605 BC. Daniel 3, sometime after chapter 2, we don't know exactly when. Daniel 4, near the end of Nebuchadnezzar's life, we're not sure of the exact year there either. Daniel 7 was the first year of Belshazzar. So we're putting this in chronological order now. Daniel 7 was the first year of Belshazzar, and that was 539 BC. Remember, Belshazzar came right after Nebuchadnezzar. He was Nebuchadnezzar's grandson, but the Bible called him the son of Nebuchadnezzar because there is no Hebrew word for grandson. Daniel 8, the third year of Belshazzar, was 536 BC, which is where we are right now. So even though we have the death of Belshazzar, which happened in 536 BC in Daniel 5, now we're in Daniel 8, and Belshazzar is still kind of around because Medo-Persians have not yet taken over and killed, at least in chapter 8. And then chapter 9, first year of Darius the Mede, that was in 536. And Daniel 10 through 12, the third year of Cyrus, 533 BC. And then finally Daniel 6, sometime after chapter 9. Again, chronologically, and we don't know the date of that. So that just gives us, again, a brief overview. Daniel received the visions of chapter 7 and 8 before chapter 5. So, is that confusing to you? It is to me a little bit. I have to stop and think about that. But again, we're talking chronologically. And when we read through Daniel from chapter 1 all the way to 12, it's not chronological. So we have to understand why it breaks up like this. It's no different than if I'm relating a story and then I stop in the middle of that story and I say, do you remember 3 years ago when we did this and then we went there and we were driving that car? Well, that's the same kind of thing. So that's kind of what's happening here. It's just, you know, a digression is really all it is. So Daniel 8 occurs during the third year of Belshazzar's reign, and that's what's happening right now. It opens with, in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, or Belshazzar, however you want to say it, a vision appeared to me. To me, Daniel. Daniel sees a ram in his vision. The ram had two horns. I just love, in this book, Daniel, because it's so visual. It's so pictorial. You know, he describes what he sees. We see the beasts, these empires, these kingdoms, and they're related somehow, for the most part, to an animal. So here we are in Daniel 8, and we get new animals, kind of new animals. We see a ram, and the ram has two horns. One horn was higher, which signifies more power. Well, the first one, Darius Mede, was the one who led his troops into Babylon. And he is the guy with his army who killed King Belshazzar and took over the Babylonian Empire. But he was not the most powerful of the two empires, of the Medes and the Persians. The Persians were more powerful, and they came up a little bit later, a few years later. That was Cyrus. Similar to the lopsidedness of the bear that we discussed in chapter 7. Remember, he had three ribs in his mouth. He's kind of lopsided. Well, he's lopsided because there's an imbalance there. The Medes and the Persians were not equal. They never found a way to completely unite cohesively. There was always this Medes and the Persians. Okay, together we can make one big empire, but there was no true cohesiveness. And of course, what happens when there's no true cohesiveness?
It falls apart.
A kingdom divided, it doesn't really stand out. Which is kind of, sadly enough, what's happening to the U.S. today.
Yeah.
We're divided. Because we've got people who, for whatever reason, either hate this country or are getting big perks to help bring it down. It's causing an internal war. So Persia was the higher horn that came up afterwards, and it exercised more power than Media, or Medes. The two kingdoms in one empire is symbolized by the ram with the two horns.
Now, this ram was interesting because when the Medes and the Persians became an empire and became a powerful entity, there was nothing that kept them from expanding west, north, or south. Nothing. Nothing stood in their way. They did whatever they wanted to. And you could tell that when they took over and conquered Babylon, Belshazzar had no response to them. Mm-hmm. He figured, they can't get in here. Because Babylon is surrounded by this wall. It was actually a double wall. So there's no way they can get in here. I will encourage you again to look up Expedition Bible on YouTube with Joel. He's an archaeologist. His stuff is fascinating. These are short videos. They're usually about 20, maybe 30 minutes maximum. And the most recent one that we watched was about Nineveh. It is absolutely fascinating. Absolutely fascinating stuff. So, I mean, and it's just really interesting. And that makes, for me, it comes alive more. Because someone's providing a mental picture for me. And he uses nice overhead shots with drones, and then he'll bring it into a computer and draw the wall of Nineveh. It's just fascinating stuff. So the ram expanded west, north, and south. No one could stop them. And then Daniel sees a goat. So he's looking at this ram. This ram is doing whatever it wants. And all of a sudden, here's this goat. And the goat is exceptionally fast moving. Matter of fact, so fast moving that it was like his feet didn't even touch the ground. He flew over the ground. And what's odd about this goat is that it has one horn. Most goats have two horns. This one has one horn. So what's interesting here is there is nobody that I know, conservative or liberal scholar, who disagrees that this is Alexander the Great. Nobody. The reason they'll say, oh, of course it's Alexander the Great, because the person who wrote the book of Daniel was alive after all this happened, so he just looked back and he wrote down history. That's how they deny the authenticity and the veracity of God's word. But anyway, they will tell you, no, that's Alexander. So Alexander came up from the west, which is where Greece is. If you look here on a map, you know it as well as I do. You've got the Mediterranean Ocean here. Here's Greece. Well, then you've got the Middle East over here. So Alexander came from the west to conquer. And he had already taken on, at this point, because he was pretty strong, he had already taken on parts of Medo-Persian Empire and defeated them three times. So now he's like, you know what? You're not stopping me. I'm going to do what I want, and I will take what I want. So he did. He had, notice this, this is an interesting word the scripture uses, furious power. Well, he was angry because of the way the Medes and the Persians had treated Greece before. So this was payback. I won't get into the whole thing, but he confronted the ram with absolute rage in verses 6 and 7. This is in response again to the Medo-Persian assault against Greece previously in history. You can look that up and read up more about it if you're interested. So the goat attacks the ram and he breaks his two horns and tramples him. This is fascinating because you'll notice that the beasts in the book of Daniel, every time they conquer something, what do? They trample. When we get to the fourth beast, not only does he trample everything that came before it, but he tramples it so much that there is nothing left of any of those previous empires. That's what they did. They not only took over, but they destroyed the remnants and then took their kingdom as part of theirs. And that's what Alexander did. The goat overcame the ram, swallowed up its kingdom, and he basically did whatever he pleased. That's what the scripture tells us. But we know that this was allowed by God. Just like what's happening here in the United States today. It's being allowed by God. Just what's happening in Europe today. The Middle East. It's all being allowed by God. Why? Because His Word tells us the world has to get to this point where it becomes this unified global new world order. And why does it have to do that? Because the world has to pretend that they are God, and that they compete with God, and that, in fact, they overcome God, Psalm 2,
and do things completely on their own. So there is no need for God anymore. That's what they're deciding. That's what the world will come to. And honestly, you know, Sylvia and I look at this and we go, well, I'm glad we have our community of believers. I'm glad we have the people in this church, the farms locally. God put us in this place for a reason. And it's a phenomenal reason. But I think of the people in blue states and blue cities.
Yeah.
And it's like, I have no idea what they're going to do, but they probably don't see anything coming except good times. I don't know. But anyway, but God did whatever he pleased that's allowed by God, because it's God who appoints kings and takes them out. And he does all of that for what? His purposes alone. Alone. That's it. And he's going to allow this world to get to a point where one guy, fully possessed and united with Satan, called the Antichrist, will then literally declare himself God. And as I've mentioned this before, the main point of what everything that Antichrist is going to try to accomplish is to gather all the troops of this world so that when Jesus returns physically, and he knows he's going to, I think this is hilarious to me. You know, people will argue about, oh, Jesus isn't coming back physically. If you're a millennialist, no, that's not a full 1,000 years, blah, blah, blah. It means spiritually. Jesus is coming spiritually. You know what? Antichrist is going to step up, and he will know beyond doubt that Jesus is going to come back physically. Period. There's no debate with him. What he will debate you is whether or not he, Antichrist, allows Jesus to return. Talk about hubris. Well, that's his job then, is going to be to take over the world, to unite all the armies of the world in a final futile attempt to keep Jesus from touching down on the Mount of Olives. I mean, when you stop to think about that, all you can see is arrogance, hubris. I mean, it's just amazing that human beings, created beings, could actually think that. And think they have a chance of it. But that's what he's going to do, because he's so united with Satan, and Satan is so blinded by his hate of God and us. He hates us. If God did not stop him, he would kill all of us before we ever had a chance to hear the gospel. That's amazing to me. So the goat did whatever he pleased. No one could withstand the goat for that time. Josephus, he was a Jewish historian, centuries ago. Josephus records that Alexander came to Jerusalem by way of Syria. So he moved across from Greece all the way across along the top of the Mediterranean, then came down through Syria, and then comes down not only through Syria, but he finally captures Damascus, and then he moves on to Sidon, and then he moves on to Tyre over a period of 7 months and captures all those cities and destroys people along the way. That's how powerful he was. He demanded supplies. This is really interesting. I mean, I can really break this down because I love history, but I won't go into it too much. Jada was the high priest in Jerusalem at the time. He demanded supplies from Jada so that he could continue his assaults. If you think about that, that's kind of like Ukraine constantly coming to the United States saying, hey, we need more money. We need more. I'm thinking to myself, dude, you started a war with Russia, but you want us to pay for it? There's something wrong with this picture. So this is what Alexander the Great did with Jada. He said, I need supplies. You need to supply me with supplies because we're running low. And they didn't have, of course, missiles and tanks then. They had horses and chariots and arrows and spears and javelins and whatever. Jada refused, deferring to Darius of Persia, because he said, look, I can't, because this guy, he's going to take it out on me if I give you your stuff, so I can't do that. Ultimately, Jada, whatever his name was, he was ultimately killed by Alexander the Great, but not immediately. Alexander destroyed Tyre, and then he went to Gaza. Isn't that interesting? Mm-hmm. We're in Gaza today. Look what's happening to Gaza. Israel's destroying it. Now they're moving on to Rafah.
Not Israel.
Israel is destroying Gaza. Yeah. They're not destroying Gaza for the sake of it. They're going after Hamas and Hezbollah. So you know, and our president is saying, oh, no, you can't do that. Don't go into Rafah. And before Israel goes into those places, they give them every chance to get out. They just went into a hospital in Rafah, found over 150 terrorists in the hospital that the UN and the UNRWA and other UN agencies says, oh no, Hamas does not do that. They don't use hospitals to shield themselves. Yes, they do. They found another 200-meter tunnel over there near Rafah, which was filled with weapons, everything. I mean, all kinds of weapons that they destroyed, Israel destroyed. So this is what they're up against. But here we are, Alexander's day, he goes into Gaza and he conquers it. And the same thing is happening today. Alexander besieged Jerusalem, and again, he eventually killed the high priest. But before he did, he sacked the gold from the temple. He took the gold from the temple. And of course, Nebuchadnezzar did that. Rome did that. Jada wrote down someplace, I think this is what Josephus records, that he had been warned in a dream not to resist Alexander.
But he did it anyway?
He did.
Okay.
Yeah. And then when he saw, but he tried to make amends. See, you know, this is politics, man. This is politics. So when he sees Alexander approaching, he goes to meet him. And allegedly, again, according to Josephus, Alexander had had a dream of the high priest where he told Alexander he would subjugate Persia. I don't know. Sounds good. Alexander offered a sacrifice as the Gentiles did in Jerusalem. The high priest then showed Alexander the prophecies of Daniel 8 and 11. This is again according to Josephus. And Alexander believed the prophecies and went to conquer the Persian Empire. But eventually, unfortunately from what I understand, Jada was eventually killed. But this is fascinating because this also happened with Darius when he was shown certain prophecies. I mean, it's just absolutely fascinating to me. So can you imagine being shown this biblical scroll and say, you're in here, here you are. Right here. It's not my name, but here you are, Alexander the Great. This is you. It's fascinating stuff. Did I get that last one? Okay, yes. So he goes on to conquer the Persian Empire. So eventually he dies, though. He was about not yet 32 years old, and he died of... he had a raging fever for one thing, and he lived a life of debauchery. And he was drinking a lot. So all those things together don't spell relief or good health. So he eventually died. His son had died before him, so he had no one to leave his empire to. So when he died, here we are in chapter 8, and it says here, okay, verse 8, therefore the male goat grew very strong, very great, but when he became strong, the large horn was broken, and in its place four notable ones came up toward the four winds of heaven. And out of one of them came a little horn. So, he dies, and basically we see four horns. And those four horns are generally acknowledged to have been Lysimachus, who took over the northern part of the Grecian Empire, Cassander, the western part of the Grecian Empire, Seleucus, the eastern part, and this would have included Syria, by the way, and then Ptolemy, the southern part, which is down toward Egypt. All right. Verse 9, and out of one of them came a little horn which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. This little horn, by the way, very important, is not the same as the little horn of Daniel 7. Totally different guy. Whoops. So, I want to stop here for a second, just pull back, and talk about Antichrist. There have been numerous Antichrist types in Scripture. The very first one was Nimrod. If you read through Genesis 10 and 11, this guy was a king already. He was a mighty man of valor. He was actually, the Bible says, a hunter of men. We don't know if he was extremely tall like Goliath or even taller like Og. Og's bed, King Og of Sihon, his bed was, I believe, well over 13, nearly 14 feet long.
and about 8 feet wide. I mean, a king-size bed would be fine with me, but a bed, why do you need a bed that big if you're not a tall person? It was made of iron, by the way.
Right.
So, obviously, King Og was a very tall man. He could have been 10 to 12 feet tall, and being 10 to 12 feet tall, he was probably very heavy. Not fat, just bone structure and mass. So he needed a bed that fully supported him, which is why his bed was made of iron. Anybody else have an iron bed in here? I don't. So, anyway, Nimrod could have been one of those gigantic people that Genesis 6 refers to as the Nephilim, the fallen ones. So, we don't know that. But anyway, whatever he was extremely... I'm sorry?
It's been speculated.
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I tend to...
As was Goliath.
Oh, yeah, he was over, what, 9 feet, 9 inches? Yeah.
He was a big boy.
And yet, here's David, what, 5'7", 5'8"? He was not a tall man. But who was on his side? God was. He guided that sling. Just to go back, what I find was interesting, why did he take 5 rocks? Did he think he was going to miss Goliath? When he picked up, when he was getting ready to go to Goliath, he reaches down and picks up 5 smooth stones. Why? Because Goliath had 4 brothers.
Uh-huh.
And he thought, I'm going to kill one of their brothers. I'm going to be ready for the 4 coming after me. And I love the fact that, I'm sorry to get off on this, but I love the fact that David, when he sees Goliath, he's not the least bit afraid, but he actually runs toward him.
Yeah.
He runs toward him. I've seen a couple of documentaries with some Middle East shepherds who are unbelievably expert, as you can imagine, in slings. And they set up one situation where they placed a porcelain mask at about the height of where Goliath would have been. And this guy just goes up. It went so fast you didn't see the rock fly, and all of a sudden the mask just shatters. It's just incredible. But that's what David did, because what else are you going to do? You needed to become an expert in that thing. So anyway, sorry to get off on that. But here's Nimrod. He was a type of Antichrist. Why? Because he was trying to unite the entire world under one government with himself as ruler. And let's build the Tower of Babel so that we can get up to heaven and literally displace God. Incredible. The little horn of Daniel 8:9, which is what we're going over right now, is also a type of Antichrist, but not the Antichrist. We're going to meet him in the second half of chapter 8 in 2 weeks. So this little horn, starting in verse 9, and out of one of them came a little horn which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. That's this guy. He's a type of Antichrist, because what was he trying to do? He was trying to create his own kingdom where he would be, and he was a king. He was the 8th king of the Seleucid Empire. And we'll get to his name. Here he is, the little horn. Was Antiochus the 4th. His father was Antiochus the 3rd, who was a king. Well, he comes along and he's another king. But check this out. He also decided to refer to himself as Epiphanes, which meant God manifest. I am here, Epiphanes. God manifest on the earth. He had coins minted with his face on it that said Epiphanes. He even, Alexander made a mistake, I think it was Alexander. He also started thinking of himself in terms of deity and then demanded that his soldiers worship him, which created problems among the ranks, as you can imagine. Some of them didn't want to do that. They highly esteemed him, but they didn't think of him as God. Well, here comes this guy who thinks he's God and wants everybody to know him. And he grew great toward the south, the east, and the glorious land, which biblically is most likely Palestine, which is where Jerusalem is, Judea, Gaza, that whole area. Syria is above it, so it's down here. But it's really interesting. He grew great toward these things. It's so interesting. We'll get into it a little bit more in chapter 11. But he was so conniving, so political, so... He would put some of our politicians to shame with the way he would be able to... He was oily, a salesman, and yet he was able to draw people around him. So this little horn is a type of little horn that will appear during the coming tribulation period. But this guy will be heads above both Nimrod and Antiochus Epiphanes.
Yeah.
He will be the epitome, because he will be the Antichrist. John talks about the fact that, you know, many Antichrists have come.
Yeah.
But the big one, the final one, has not come yet. And so he will be here, and he will fool most of the people living on earth at that point. He will fool most of the people living on earth. And that's going to be the second half, as I said, of Daniel 8. So Antiochus IV was the king, eighth king of the Seleucid dynasty. He ruled from 175 to 164, which in those days was a pretty long time. It really was. I mean, we're reading through 1 and 2 Samuel right now in our daily reading, and it's really fascinating to me that Saul becomes the first king of Israel. And then we find out, not soon after that, he does something and says, God says to Samuel, you know, I'm really sorry I made this guy king. I'm rejecting him. And yet, Saul ruled for 42 years. The same length of time David did. So even though God had rejected him, he allowed him to finish out his term, so to speak. But what's interesting here is, as things got really going with all the nations, that's a pretty decent time to be ruling as far as the length of time. And that's in the extra biblical books, which are considered by conservative scholars to be fairly accurate historical books. They're not scripture, not in the least, but they're, neither is Josephus, but they're historical books. First Maccabees. He conducted military campaigns in all directions except westward. He didn't go back to Greece because other people controlled those areas. But here in Daniel 8, the vision begins to focus right here. We're going to see a change from verse 14 through 15 and following, which we won't get into today. But here in Daniel 8, the vision begins to focus on future Israel. Certainly it was future from Daniel's perspective, but some of what we're going to cover next time is still future from our perspective, which can be confusing, but it's interesting. So Antiochus was especially vengeful against the Jews, whom he persecuted brutally. I mean, what he did to the Jews, long before Hitler was on the scene, was unconscionable. Whitcomb, another commentator, notes that he was one of Israel's worst persecutors ever. One thing that Hitler didn't do, because it wasn't standing at the time, but it'd be interesting to know if it had been standing what he might have done. There was no temple during Hitler's day. No temple. So he just decided to kill Jews. And so many people deny that the Holocaust ever happened. But it wasn't just Jews that he killed. He killed millions of Gentiles as well. But the reality is, there was no temple. So we don't really know what Hitler would have done. I have a sneaking suspicion he probably would have gone in and created some kind of sacrilege had the temple been standing. But we know that Israel wasn't even a nation at that point, because it was decades before that. But Antiochus was just unbelievable for his hubris, his arrogance, his hatred of Jews. Just hated them. And whenever I read of somebody on Twitter or X or any social media that hates Jews, I immediately know, they can call themselves a Christian, but I immediately know they're under Satan's deception. They're totally deceived. Because how can you hate, and here's what I hear. I just read this today. A guy was talking to a Jewish woman on X, and he said, oh, you people, you people killed Jesus. And he just goes on and on and on and on. And I'm thinking to myself, well, no, everybody had a hand in that. Mm-hmm. The Romans did. The Romans are Gentiles. The Romans actually nailed him to the cross. The Jews made it possible. But ultimately, it was God's design. Why? So that you and I could have salvation. Mm-hmm. Satan didn't understand that at all. Paul tells us in Corinthians, had Satan known that, he would never have incited the crowd to crucify Jesus. Didn't matter if it's Jews or Gentiles. It was all Satan. So when I hear these people who absolutely have this unfathomable hate for Jews, anti-Semitism, it's like, if it weren't for Jews and Israel, Jesus would not have come into this life. He would not have lived a perfect life. He would not have given himself for our sin. So, like Paul says in Romans 9 through 11, we owe a debt of gratitude to Israel, to the Jews. And I'm fine with that. I'm fine with that. So, anyway, let's keep going. Sorry. Ancient sources for Antiochus, again, are 1st and 2nd Maccabees and Josephus. They're really good if you ever have the time to read any of that stuff. Antiochus killed 40,000 Jews in just one assault on Jerusalem. Now remember, he did this not with weapons of war that we have today. He didn't drop bombs. He didn't shoot drones. He didn't have any of that stuff. He didn't have tanks. It was all done hand-to-hand combat. 40,000 Jews. And he took 10,000 of them that survived into captivity. And Nebuchadnezzar did kind of the same thing. But he didn't destroy that many Jews. He just went in, took what he wanted from the temple. Jews often just gave themselves up because that's what God had told them they needed to do. So in 168 B.C., Antiochus was... This is interesting. He was on his way down to Alexandria. He wanted to expand his borders some more. He wanted to make his empire bigger. So what does he do? Well, you go down south, because I've already gone west... And I've gone north. I need to go south. And I'm going to take Alexandria and start chipping away at the Egyptian Empire down there. So he heads down there. And he's met with this guy, an elderly gentleman. I should say he's a slightly older gentleman. But he's a Roman commander, Papilius Lianus. And basically, he meets him, Antiochus. And he says, no, if you do this, you're going to face Rome. If you continue and try to take Alexandria, you're going to face the Roman Empire. And so what this guy did, Papilius did, here was Antiochus standing there. He went over to him and drew a line in the dirt, a circle around him. Because Antiochus said, well, I'll check with my people and we'll get back with you. So he drew a circle around him and he said, nope. You give me an answer now. Or you're not coming out of that circle alive. And so Antiochus, he was by himself. He basically said, okay, fine. And he agreed not to attack Alexandria. And then he turned around and went back north. Well, as you can imagine, he was not happy. Because his plans to expand his empire, just like Antichrist is going to do, were buffeted. He was kept from doing this. So as he went north back to Syria, he passed through Israel, Jerusalem. And as soon as he got there, that's when he began to attack the Jews. And it was on a Sabbath. So they couldn't fight back. So in 164, Judas Maccabees, the Hammer, Jewish nationalist, led the Jews to rededicate the temple. And this is a successful campaign. You've heard of it. It became known as Hanukkah. Verse 10, and the little horn grew up to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host and some of the stars to the ground and trampled them. Some commentators believe the stars to the ground, you know, the host of heaven is referring to angels. But the question is, how could human beings go to reach up into the heavens and throw angels down? You can't do it. So this is probably more likely referring to Jewish people, because don't forget, in numerous places, Genesis 26:4, what does God promise? I will make your
descendants as numerous as the stars of heaven. So this is probably referring to Jews, and also includes an attempted assault on God through his people. Anytime people attack, hate, try to destroy, or succeed in destroying Jewish people like they did on October 7th, that's not just people attacking Jews. That is Satan using people to attack God. And the Jews are still his chosen people, and he is not done with Israel yet. Romans 9 through 11 proves that point. Some believe the stars, as I mentioned. It's not humans. It's not angels. So here's what Antiochus did. He waltzes in there, and he desecrated the temple. He exalted himself to a position. Remember, we talked about this before, when a conquering army would go into another empire and conquer that empire. What would they do? They'd waltz in and they'd steal that empire's gods and take those gods back with them, and usually put them in a subservient position in their own room with all their gods, their own temple. That was normal, because why? They were telling people, see, we are more powerful than this empire. Our gods are more powerful than those gods. And that's what Antiochus thought too. He waltzed into the temple and he desecrated it. How did he desecrate it? He basically took swine, pig, slaughtered it on the altar that was standing at the time, inside the temple. And then he sprinkled the blood of the pig all around the altar. Nothing happened to him at that point. So why wouldn't Antiochus think, I'm more powerful than the God of the Israelites? Because the God of the Israelites didn't stop me. That's the way people thought. But what obviously Antiochus didn't realize is that God allowed this for his own purposes as a measure of discipline to his people who had gotten way off track. And we see that over and over. It's a continuing cycle throughout the Old Testament. You want to see it in a truncated version, read Judges. It's sad. It's just this constant cycle. Downward cycle. So verse 12 notes that God allowed Antiochus to do this because of what he calls the transgression of the Jews. God used him as an arm of discipline, the way he used Nebuchadnezzar, the way he used Cyrus. But those guys were fairly benevolent to, for the most part, to Israel, not Antiochus. So, whether he destroyed the temple or not, some commentators believe he did. Some said, no, he didn't really physically destroy it. What he did was he made it a worthless place to sacrifice because it was completely desecrated. So, in order to be able to use it, it had to go through a cleansing process, which is what Judas Maccabees later helped initiate. So Antiochus' actions look forward to the actions of the Antichrist when the new temple will be standing at some point in Israel, Jerusalem, and then this guy, Antichrist, will waltz into that temple that's standing, and he will do the same stupid thing. He will declare himself to be God, and nothing will happen to him at that point. And why does God allow that? Because the Jews, they will be so far off base, except for those that God has already begun saving during the tribulation. And those sealed, 144,000, for those of you who are in Revelation, that's when those people come in handy. And also, the two witnesses. I came across, you know, how many of you think that the two witnesses in Revelation are Moses and Elijah? Anybody? How many think that it's Enoch and Elijah? Okay, what's fascinating, I was reading some stuff. These are recently translated scrolls of 1st, 2nd, and 3rd century church fathers. They come right out and tell you the two witnesses are Enoch and Elijah. This is from the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, early 3rd century. The same church fathers, by the way, will tell you that Paul wrote Hebrews.
Mm-hmm.
Did he? I don't know. But that's what they thought, so they must have had some information that we don't. But anyway, it's fascinating to me. Where am I? Okay. 2,300 days. We can't be dogmatic about this. There are a number of interpretations. Verse 13, Daniel hears these holy ones talking. They're angels. Can you imagine this? They're listening. Here's a holy one.
He says to somebody else, who's a holy one. The holy one answers, or asks a question. And why did they ask these questions? How long will this continue to go on? Here's Daniel. Holy angel to holy angel. They don't need to ask these questions. But they're doing it for Daniel's benefit.
Yeah.
So, how long will the sanctuary be trampled underfoot? 2,300 days.
Oh.
And Daniel's trying to figure out, what would you be doing? I'd be going, well, what's the starting point?
Yeah.
I want to know, when does that start? And that's where the confusion is. Because we don't know exactly when that starts. And there's some excellent possible interpretations of this. I'll just put a couple up here. So for 2,300 days, this number could be the time between 167 and 164 during Antiochus, which would be a total of 1,150 24-hour days, according to the Jewish calendar, which means 3 years, 2 months, and 10 days. That's one possibility. During this period, Antiochus did whatever he wanted to the temple and the Jews. He died in this year. Another view also says, no, this actually refers to the far latter days when Antichrist does something during the tribulation period, because he's going to desecrate it again. And it may begin with the abomination of desolation, which makes sense, that Paul talks about in 2 Thessalonians 2, as he sits in the temple declaring himself to be God, and the world goes, there he is, God, that's who we've been waiting for. Look, he's not dead. Look at that. So he must be God. So when he does that, that desecrates the temple. That could be the time when the 2,300 days starts. Some people believe that it's really a figurative number, but it really, I don't know, I had doubt that, because other numbers in Daniel are literal.
Yeah, they're real.
So why would Daniel insert a figurative number here? It doesn't make sense. Ken Johnson, another theologian I really enjoyed reading, believes the 2,300 days represents literal days. It starts in the middle of the tribulation when Antichrist desecrates the temple, and it goes until the dedication of the millennial temple after the end, and he figures out all the days. So that's also a strong possibility. I don't know.
If you go back, when was the Maccabean revolt? Was that like 3 years after?
That was what?
Death?
Yeah. Well, I don't know the date.
Okay. The MacArthur study notes.
Yeah.
Go along those lines. It says the period runs to about six and one third years of sacrificing the lamb twice a day, morning and evening. Exodus 29, blah, blah, blah. The prophecy was precise in identifying the time as that of Antiochus' persecution, September 6, 171 B.C. to December 25, 165-164 B.C.
Yeah.
After his death, Jews celebrated the cleansing of their holy place in the Feast of Lights, or Hanukkah,
yep,
in celebration of the restoration led by Judas Maccabeus.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so
it could have been.
That could totally be it. I don't know. I don't know which one I come down on. I'd have to really study it more. But MacArthur makes sense. Johnson makes sense. It could also be a near-far thing.
It could be both.
It could.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I guess we'll see when we get there, if we get there. Who knows? So anyway, next time, here's what we're going to be looking at. The little horns of Daniel 7 and Daniel 8, as we get into the second portion of Daniel 8, and we're going to see some similarities and some huge differences. The little horn of chapter 7 is, of course, the Antichrist, if you'll recall. The little horn of chapter 8 is Antiochus Epiphanes. And then we'll finish the chapter as Gabriel interprets the vision that was given to Daniel, that he was privileged to see. And then that will take us... I just want to read this last verse of chapter 8. The last two verses. He says, therefore, seal up the vision, for it refers to many days in the future. Mm. Toward the end, really. Yeah. Which is where we are today. Verse 27. And I, Daniel, fainted and was sick for days. Afterward, I arose and went about the king's business. I was astonished by the vision, but no one understood it. I think that's absolutely fascinating. Poor guy. I mean, he had this vision, couldn't understand it really. Why? Because for the rest of chapter 8, it's not for his time. It's way down the line. And it's how God's going to deal with the Jews, Israel, and purify Israel. And there's going to be a lot of terrible things, but ultimately, God is going to do what he does. Anyway.
But he gives us the gift of Scripture to understand it.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a phrase.
Any questions? Comments?